to episode 2 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thanks for joining us. We are joined today by Michael Vadas in our New York office, litigator and privacy lawyer, by Jason Weinstein from our Washington office, also a litigator, civil and criminal, as well as privacy. I'm the host, Stuart Baker, practicing a variety of cybersecurity law, and we are pleased to be joined today by Stephanie Roy, who is a Steptoe telecom and transactional lawyer who was deeply involved in the net neutrality decision that just came down. We're going to pick her brain about what that means. So let's jump in. Everybody is waiting as I speak for the president to announce what he's going to do with his experts working group report on the National Security Agency and how to respond to the various flaps created by Edward Snowden's leaks. We don't know what the president is going to do, but there's been a steady process of taking the most controversial recommendations from the working group off the table. The president's not going to change Cyber Command into a separate entity. He's almost certainly not going to get rid of the security arm of the National Security Agency. He's pretty much said he's not going to move the metadata telephony program from the National Security Agencies to some kind of third party, either carriers or to the to a nonprofit. So I think it's fair to say that the working group's most ambitious things are not going to get adopted. But it's also pretty clear that the president is extraordinarily concerned about, as he should be, the international reaction. He's trying to find things that will make our allies, our sometime allies, people who don't hate us, maybe even people who do hate us, feel less uneasy about the National Security Agency's intelligence collection. That's not an easy thing to do. But it seems likely that he's going to say something about protecting the privacy of foreigners, something that the intelligence agencies have never been inclined to do since they exist to breach the privacy of others. Michael, can you think of a plausible way to address the privacy concerns of, say, German nationals without gutting our intelligence capabilities?
Well, one way is to agree not to engage in surveillance on certain select foreign leaders. So you'd at least be respecting Angela Merkel's privacy rights. The other way would be to follow the report's recommendation that somehow the Privacy Act of 1974 be extended to foreigners, which, frankly, I don't really even understand how that would do much for privacy. Theoretically, it would allow foreigners to access data about them, but, you know, it's hard to even conceive of foreigners accessing data held about them by the NSA or the FBI. So, and it was a very ambiguous recommendation, so I don't see that happening. What I would expect is some sort of broad statement that requires the intelligence agencies to think carefully about whether the infringement on privacy rights of foreigners is really worth it.
Yeah, I think that's something like that is probably right. This is the incredible shrinking scandal, as far as I can see. Less and less looks likely to come out of all of these leaks. But my guess is that the president will say, we don't want you to just go gather foreign persons' data for no good reason. There has to be a foreign intelligence reason for it. You only should maintain the data if there's a foreign intelligence reason for it. We want to do a very careful scrub. If you want to go after the communications of the leaders of our allies, there'd better be a damn good reason, and you'd better be prepared to explain it to the deputies committee or something of the sort. That would actually potentially have some significant deterrence of intelligence gathering, but as long as he doesn't write it into law and makes it instead a kind of policy process, then there can be corrections later on.
I think that's right. I think the one interesting thing will be whether whatever he says can be interpreted as restricting the NSA's ability to grab whole streams of information so that it can pick out relevant foreign intelligence. Now, if that is considered a violation of privacy, even when they don't actually examine all of that data, then that could be problematic, and that could be problematic for cybersecurity as well. But I wouldn't expect them to go that far, but who knows?
Yeah, I think a little more likely that they will. He probably will say something about, just gathering big rafts of data without any particular reason because you think later you'd like to search it is a disfavored way of gathering intelligence. That would be not particularly smart, but it would be an understandable reaction. And as long as there's a way to justify the collection through some discretionary classified process that goes up to the White House, it will gradually become, align itself with reality in some fashion.
Yep.
All right. Since we don't know what he's going to say, that's probably enough on that topic.
I would say one of the things that was interesting this week is that the chief judge of the FISA court actually sent a letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee opposing a number of the proposals, including at least one that I think most people assume is likely to get adopted, which is the appointment of a public advocate to appear in front of the FISA court. And the FISA court also expressed opposition to a requirement of judicial approval for national security letters, two things that we talked about in our first episode.
It could be that Judge Bates was listening to our podcast. I thought it was interesting. It was a very direct statement and quite politically attuned. I think it probably is the last nail in the coffin of the NSL proposal, which was quite ambitious and had nothing to do with the National Security Agency. Looked like somebody's hobby horse. But his discouraging words about the advocate, I thought was both appropriate and probably likely to have a pretty significant impact, because he was basically saying, no clients, just saying whatever they want to, slowing down routine cases. Why don't you just let us tell the advocate when we need help, and he can come in and give us amicus help? That's all we really need, is an ability to bring in a lawyer occasionally for an amicus brief.
They could do that on their own, presumably, but to have an advocate that's there for every case or every significant matter, however they define it, really would require legislation. So the president can say, I'm in favor of this, and then kick the ball over to Congress, and I don't think that's going to go anywhere in Congress, frankly, certainly not in both houses. The alternative, I suppose, is to have some sort of privacy advocate within the Department of Justice. The president could do that on his own. In the OIPR.
National Security Division would say we already are an advocate. For
right.
Privacy.
Yeah.
So force the National Security Agency to justify everything they want to do. It would be impossible, I think, optically, to put it inside the Justice Department.
Although ultimately, it may not amount to much, even if the president says he likes the idea.
I think he will say he likes the idea, but my guess is he will leave it much vaguer than he otherwise would have, and thus the Senate will fight between the Feinstein version, which is apparently quite minimalist, and the Blumenthal version, which I think I described in testimony as an advocracy. So we'll just have to see how that turns out. But you're right, betting on stasis and a failure to implement legislation is never a bad bet in Washington, especially now. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about private issues, and Target, or as those of us who do our shopping at Walmart call it, Target, had a brutal breach of everybody's payment information. Jason, what actually happened, and who's going to start filing suits over this?
Well, the suits are already coming, even before we know what happened, which is part of the problem with the way this country deals with data breaches generally. But it, you know, it's not just Target, but Neiman Marcus and T-Mobile breaches. They had the good fortune to announce their breaches at the same time that the uproar of Target was going on, so more people are focused on Target. In recent weeks, the initial reports of the Target breach were the credit card and debit card data got compromised, card numbers, names, and security codes on the back of the cards. The second revelation was that some PIN numbers had been compromised, but those had been encrypted. Now, in the last week or so, it's been revealed that names and phone numbers and addresses and physical and email addresses had been potentially compromised as well, and that the universe of potential victims had grown from 40 million to 70 million to potentially as large as 110 million, which would move Target up near the top of a list that nobody wants to be on of the largest data breaches in the United States. Right now, for people who keep score on these things, the largest retailer data breach is the TJX breach in the mid-2000s, which affected up to 90 million people, and the largest breach of any kind is the Heartland Payment Systems breach that affected 130 million, both investigated by the Department of Justice and prosecuted when I was there. And Target is potentially going to be somewhere in the middle or perhaps approach Heartland as well.
How many Americans have credit cards? I mean, this must really be pushing the edge of how many people have credit cards.
Yeah, basically a quarter of the country's population, so you're really getting up there. You know, the lawsuit started almost immediately. The first lawsuit that I'm aware of was filed within about 3 or 4 hours of Target announcing the breach in mid-December. There have been about 40 or 50 suits that have followed, alleging, you know, variety, you know, sort of a garden variety of offenses, including negligence and breach of contract and unfair business practices and, in some cases, data breach notification law, state law violations. And more recently, Target was sued by one of the banks it does business with, and that will be the first of many as well, because the banks and credit card companies will then sue for having to cover the losses on the fraudulent transactions.
That strikes me as, you know, I think we all know more or less what the liability for breach to consumers is, and it's not tiny, but it's some hundreds of dollars per consumer, I would have thought. But when you start having lawsuits filed by the banks and the card companies that have lots of expenses and maybe eating these fraudulent charges, that could add up.
But when a hacker steals credit card data, and they use the card to make transactions, they're stealing the bank's money and the credit card company's money, and they want it back. And the people that they're going to go to try to get it back are the retailer that got breached in the first place. But Target's nightmare is not confined to civil litigation and the reputational harm that they've suffered and the actual revenue harm they've suffered since this got announced. The FTC hasn't publicly acknowledged that it's investigating, but I would bet my mortgage, not all of our mortgages.
They always shoot the wounded.
And there are at least 30 state attorneys general that have acknowledged that they're investigating, too. And this case, in many ways, exemplifies what we've all always talked about, which is the sort of blame the victim attitude that we have in the United States about data breaches. There seems to be a presumption that if you are breached, then by definition, the security measures you had in place were not reasonable. The definition of reasonableness is somehow that you were not breached, which is absurd. And there are members of Congress and members of the public, but most notably members of Congress, who seem to have assumed that Target was at fault for the breach, even now when we don't really know what happened yet. There are members of Congress who have referred to Target as breaching their duty to their customers as if they have done something to cause the breach to have occurred. In the wake of all this, there has been the predictable congressional response. Senator Leahy has reintroduced the bill that he introduced several times, calling for a national data breach notification standard and some basic data security standards for American retailers. There's talk of even more powers for the FTC, although I think a lot of American companies would tell you the FTC is doing just fine without any clear authority. And I think what this is, you know, it's a nightmare for Target, and it's a but for the grace of God moment for every other major retailer, and to act now before a breach occurs to make sure that they have done the legal and technical and administrative things that they're capable of doing, because there's no perfect security, but that they've done the things that anyone could reasonably expect them to do, so that they mitigate the risk of a breach occurring. But if one does occur, they're at least in the best position to argue to a state attorney general or to the FTC or to a jury someday that they were not negligent, that they took what is a reasonable set of steps by any measure to protect their network.
This, if I remember, you know, the card companies have done a, that is to say the two big card companies have set a variety of security standards, the PCI standards, and I would have thought at least the banks would have trouble recovering if Target actually followed those standards.
And I think that is the case. If it turns out that Target followed those standards, I think that will be a bar to recovery. It's not clear exactly how the breach occurred or if it was only one type of compromise or multiple compromises that were discovered or revealed at the same time. The initial report suggests that the compromise was to Target's point-of-sale system, you know, where they swipe the cards. One of the lawsuits that was filed in the last 2 weeks actually alleges that Target was put on notice of weaknesses in its point-of-sale system back in 2007 and breached the duty by failing to act in response to those warnings. There have been a number of big American retailers that have been affected by point-of-sale intrusions, and most people don't think that when you go to Pottery Barn and you see people doing inventory on a handheld computer or when you swipe your card, that those are largely unprotected ways to get into the company's network, and once a bad guy's in the network, you know, they can move around and do real damage. But I think that, you know, the jury's still out. All of the juries are still out on what Target did or didn't do and whether they're responsible at all. But I think it's troubling that the reaction that people have is to blame the company immediately and to focus more on the company than on the people who attack them.
Yeah, although I think a lot of members of the business community would say if the end result is a set of national standards on breach notification and security that actually preempt all of the state standards, business may be better off, despite the uncomfortableness that comes with being a pinata for the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't solve the problem of civil litigation and the regulators, but it is a compliance nightmare for companies to have to figure out, especially those that do business nationwide and have customers in most, if not all, of the 50 states. There are 46 different state laws governing breach notification, and then some in U.S. territories as well. And that kind of complicated compliance system is really only good for lawyers like us. It's not good for the clients.
Oh, my God.
but the companies themselves would be better served by clarity and an easier path to compliance.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you. Now, for our special guest, Stephanie Roy, who's worked often with me on tech and transactional issues, but who was on the briefs in the net neutrality case that just came down from the D.C. Circuit. I've never seen more confused press on a major appellate decision than on this one. Stephanie, who actually won? Is net neutrality dead? Pining for the fjords? What's the story?
Well, if I were net neutrality, I would say don't put me in the ground yet. I'm not dead yet. it was a mixed bag for the FCC. Obviously, the court struck down its anti-discrimination and no-blocking rules, which were the core of its net neutrality regulations. It did allow to stand the transparency regulations, i.e. the disclosure regulations. But what it did say was that, yes, FCC, you do, was a reasonable interpretation of the statute, that to say that you do have authority over these matters under 706, and there was a sufficient connection between the steps that you took and the mandate that Congress put forth for you in Section 706 of the 96 Telecom Act. But where you misstepped, FCC, was where you implemented regulations that smack too closely of common carrier obligations. And you have explicitly said that broadband access providers are not common carriers. So in the absence of common carrier classification for the broadband access providers you cannot impose common carrier obligations on them. So this leaves the FCC with a number of choices. Yes, they can ask for an en banc, but, you know, we had basically two Democratic appointees who issued this opinion. You have majority now, especially now, you know, Democratic appointee D.C. Circuit, not likely to get a different result. You can ask a cert. Questions of getting it, questionable, right? But there are some avenues that actually we see in the opinion that leave open and makes for some decent arguments on cert. I take the opportunity to mention that we're going to do a more detailed webinar on the intricacies of the net neutrality decision on February 6th. Pantelis Michalopoulos and Mark Amerikson of the firm. Pantelis argued the case for the interveners at the D.C. Circuit. Markham is counsel for the Open Internet Coalition, one of the interveners. And I will moderate that, so we'll give you more detailed breakdown. But what seems to be the more likely avenue for the FCC now, perhaps, is to say, what can we do within the auspices of the D.C. Circuit's decision?
Which means they can impose obligations, but they can't look like
common carrier obligations. Right. Is there a minimum level of service they can require? If you tell yourself or advertise yourself as giving access to the Internet, then maybe you really need to give access to the Internet. Is it a advertising, is it a truth in advertising type of regulation you can put out there? Obviously, you know, there's another avenue they can take. They can reclassify. That's a big political lift, I think. But it is out there. There are a lot of advocates.
Turn the Internet into a public utility and
good. That the common, that broadband access to the home, that the pipe to the home, is akin to the telephone line to the home and classify it as common carriage.
That is a really big lift, isn't it?
It's not such a big lift legally.
It's political.
I think the D.C. Circuit made that very clear. It was almost an open invitation to the FCC to pursue that action.
Half the people who want to see net neutrality are afraid of the FCC regulating the Internet through this tool, right?
I don't know if I'd go so far as that, because the consumer groups are pretty united in what they want the FCC to do.
But all the old Internet hippies are afraid of letting government regulate here.
Including some billionaire hippies.
I'm not quite of the hippie generation, so I really can't speak to how they come out. I do know that the FCC is going to evaluate their options. They have 45 days to ask for en banc review. They have 90 days to ask for cert. Obviously, they can initiate a rulemaking whenever they wish. They've got, you know, three Democratic commissioners that will at least support the initiation of a rulemaking. So we'll see where they go.
Okay, so it's a mixed bag, but net neutrality per se is in pretty deep trouble, but some kind of halfway house to net neutrality could survive. Is that a fair?
Yes, very easily under the D.C. Circuit's opinion. Some minimum level of service, perhaps, or some other avenues. And, again, I'm not going to rule out the reclassification efforts. There were really strong advocates for it. 4 years ago, there are some say that Jenikowski missed the boat by not pursuing it at the time, that the lift is heavier now that they've got two decisions kind of against their regulations in this space. But that seems to be the more probabilistic, you know, if you're a betting person to, and now the betting's legal in Maryland, I can say that, right?
Yep.
To say that that's the way it may happen.
Okay. Well, that at last I understand, to the extent that I ever will, this, unless I attend the webinar on what date?
February 6th, I'll moderate. Pantelis Michalopoulos and Mark Amerikson of Steptoe will provide you details.
So look for that on the Steptoe website. Okay, now, quick lightning round to pick up the other stories of the week. Well, here's an evergreen. Google fined in France for privacy violations. Michael, what was that?
Well, earlier this month, actually, not just the French but also the Spanish Data Protection Authority issued fines against Google over its unified privacy policy. You may recall back in 2012, Google decided to consolidate 60-some privacy policies for its various services into one omnibus privacy policy that essentially allows Google to combine all the data it may have about you from your use of its various services and use all that data together for whatever purposes it wants, delivering targeted ads, doing analysis of your use of the Internet, et cetera. The DPA's essentially cited that this violated the French and Spanish laws, and actually there was an earlier decision by the Dutch DPA holding pretty much the same thing. And that where they found fault was in what they considered Google's failure to adequately explain why it was collecting all this data and consolidating it and explaining how it processed the data. Also, they said Google doesn't allow users to access and correct any errors in their personal information that Google has. The French DPA said that Google doesn't really have an adequate justification for collecting and combining all of this information, which would probably be shocking news to Google because obviously it has its own business rationale for doing that. There are three other individual European DPAs under investigation. So I would expect that those come out the same way. The big question is, what's Google going to do about it? Because it hasn't been shy about not complying with these sorts of laws and requirements in the past. So we'll have to wait and see.
So can't they just pay the fine and just go on or correct some of the things? I mean, the idea that they can't collect it because they don't have a good enough reason does strike me as striking at the heart of Google's business model, and it's the reason we get all this stuff for free. So it would be hard for them to abandon that, and even if they went back to the old privacy policy, they still have the same objection could be made. They're gathering the same amount of information.
I think that's right. And I think what Google will probably do, and this is just pure speculation, is try to accommodate the concerns of the DPAs to some extent without going all the way. Because if they went all the way, they'd probably need to get rid of this unified privacy policy. But as you suggested, the fines are not a big deal to Google. The French fine was 150,000 euros, and the Spanish one was 900,000 euros, which is certainly real money to you and me, but it's not to Google.
Well, in a related story, Google's privacy officer put on his blog that the EU data protection rewrite, the comprehensive rewrite, is dead. This enormous effort to rewrite those laws has been, really, it's been dying longer than Francisco Franco was dying. when it finally goes, I think we'll be just as happy as we were when he went under. Is there any hope at all that you see of that thing getting through before the entire European Parliament has to go out and try to get reelected?
No. I think it's premature to say it's dead, completely dead. As Stephanie would say, it's not dead yet. But it's not going to get enacted anytime soon. And so it's certainly on life support, and maybe for a long time. I think there will certainly be some sorts of modifications to the existing data protection directive, but whether this huge regulation that's been circulating now for a while and been hammered from all sides, we're not going to see that actually passed in the next year, maybe not even two or more.
Well, with the brainchild and the signature initiative of Viviane Reding, who is a political force, at least in this commission, and I have to say was nominated for Privacy Hypocrite of the Year in the privies, but came in distant last place, if I remember. So this is bad for her career unless she decides she'd rather have the issue than the result, and campaigns for a new and more privacy-focused parliament where she'll be a bigger force. And I guess that's a possibility. Let me turn to Virginia, where restaurants who are getting reviewed have decided that they ought to sue their critics for libel. And the courts have said, yeah, at least you can get take that first step and determine who these people are who wrote their, who panned your establishment. Jason, what's going on there, and why would the court unmask these critics?
Well, it turns out, at least in Virginia, anonymity is not absolute, and you're never quite as anonymous as you think you are online. The case that you're talking about actually involved a carpet cleaning service. It's based in Virginia, although it probably has also happened to restaurants. But the carpet cleaning service got a significant number of negative reviews and was particularly interested in challenging seven of them that were anonymous and were quite unflattering. And they believed that the bad reviews were not from real customers of their service, but were either the same person posting multiple reviews under multiple identities, or were just not from actual customers, and that would violate Yelp's terms of service if that was the case. So they wanted to bring suit against the anonymous posters for libel, and to facilitate that, they got the court to issue a subpoena seeking the identities of the seven anonymous reviewers. And a local judge in Northern Virginia actually sided with them and ruled that Yelp had to comply with the subpoena, so Yelp challenged it on appeal. And most recently, the Virginia Court of Appeals actually upheld the lower court and said that Yelp had to comply. And the court said that under Virginia law, the carpet cleaning service, the plaintiff, had made enough of a factual showing that the posters may not be real customers to justify requiring Yelp to provide their identities. The issue in this particular case is whether what the standard should be, whether the plaintiff made enough of a factual showing to justify identifying those folks. The larger question is when are you truly anonymous? And
Do you remember what they actually were able to show, or was that not covered?
My recollection is that they showed in part the fact that there were, Yelp had pointed to the fact that they were posted from multiple IP addresses, and the carpet cleaning service made the point that given the number of devices people have access to, you could make it look like you're multiple people using multiple IP addresses. But the real issue is what facts you have to introduce to support the allegation. And I think the critics of the opinion would say that all the carpet cleaning service did was make a supposition that these folks were not real customers.
Yeah, just to say, well, we just think they are, and just because there are multiple IP addresses doesn't mean for sure that they aren't the same person is not exactly an affirmative showing.
And there's very little factual development, so it's almost impossible to see how someone could actually make a convincing showing that, enough to satisfy a court.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe the argument is you can show actual malice if somebody violates the terms of service in order to trash you, and it turns out the stories are inaccurate. I'm going to think twice before I review some of the services I've gotten on Yelp. Here's my favorite story of the week. The Tenth Amendment Center, Utah and California legislators who don't like the National Security Agency have decided that state governments are going to cut off services to the National Security Agency's data centers. No water, no electricity for you, and therefore you won't be able to run your evil data processing capabilities. Why didn't South Carolina think of this in 1860? If they said, I'm sorry, Fort Sumter, no food, no water for you. We could have saved all that unpleasantness between the states. They just would have, the federal government would have said, oh, okay, I guess we should go away. This is bizarre. But let me turn to a serious case, which is Snapchat. Jason, did you follow that? They seem to have gotten themselves into terrible trouble by the way they handled their intrusion, and I'm wondering how badly they screwed up.
Well, one of the interesting things about it is that the trouble they're in was sort of self-inflicted. It's all utterly avoidable. Some time ago, a group of security researchers alerted Snapchat to holes in their security that would allow usernames and phone numbers of Snapchat users to be compromised. And Snapchat plugged the hole, but I guess in the judgment of security researchers didn't plug it quickly enough. And so a group of security researchers actually exploited that hole before it had been plugged and posted about 4.6 million usernames and phone numbers online. Unlike the folks who did the target breach, which we talked about before, who were motivated to steal money, these folks were apparently motivated to shame Snapchat for not doing enough to protect its users' privacy. To me, there's two lessons in this. One is when a security researcher alerts you to a hole in your system, you need to plug it right away. You don't make them angry. You wouldn't like them when they're angry. And second, you may recall that Snapchat back in November rejected a $3 billion cash offer from Facebook to acquire it because there were other competing offers, and I think they thought they had greater value. The second lesson for me, at least, is when a company offers to buy you for $3 billion, you might want to consider taking it.
Well, I knew they were in trouble when they announced that they had hired Podesta and Partners to represent them on the Hill, because that's an expensive and proposition that indicates that you really think you have a problem. I have to point out, this is not John Podesta, who's now in the White House. This is not Tony Podesta, who had Podesta and Associates for the longest time. This is Heather Podesta, the ex-wife of, I think, Tony Podesta, who has also started a firm to do government affairs work. I'm thinking that really we should change our name to Podesta and Johnson. I would get business just by virtue of that. Are they in serious trouble on the Hill? Can you tell?
Well, they clearly think they are. I mean, if your first move is to hire a lobbyist, then, or one of your first moves is to hire a lobbyist, then you're worried about those consequences. The reality is that the people who did this hack redacted some of the phone numbers so that the information couldn't be misused. I mean, they're not to defend it, but their motives weren't profit-oriented. I don't know that they're in any more trouble on the Hill than any other company that's been the subject of a major breach. What makes it interesting is Snapchat has sort of made its mark as a service that almost by definition or by operation protects your privacy, because the photos and videos you can send self-destruct.
Superior.
So it's more, I think, a tremendous embarrassment, which I guess was the objective in the first place, that a service that prides itself on privacy is viewed as not being sufficiently protective of privacy. But what I think it underscores is the notion that any company, you're talking about Target, which is one of the biggest retailers in the world, and Snapchat, which 3 years ago no one had ever heard of, both are at risk of different types of compromise. And I think it underscores the fact that there is no such thing as perfect security, no matter what size you are, no matter what kind of business you're in.
Okay, that is episode 2 of the Steptoe and Johnson Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We've had on our panel Stuart, Michael, Stephanie, and Jason Podesta. Michael Davis, Jason Weinstein, Stephanie Roy, and Stuart Baker. We hope you'll join us next week for more insight into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. For more information on us or our practice, please visit www.steptocyberblog.com. Thank you very much.